So good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning, those of us in the hall and those at home. So this past week, I had the good experience of participating in what we call our presenter training. Angie's put together a four-session workshop class to deepen the skills of those in the community who find various formats within our community to present, whether Dharma talk, class, workshop, or other venues. And this is the second time Angie has done it. And I believe there were about 14 people in it. And sort of at the end, they are asked to prepare a 15-minute talk, which they tape, and then they get feedback, critical feedback from their peers, also Angie. And I'm invited in the last session to speak to the people and discuss what's been going on. Anyhow, that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to talk about was the topic. The topic was that, because they all had the same topic, which was the second noble truth of Buddhism. And so it was very interesting to listen to 14 different members present. It was only the topic. How they went about it was really up to them. So it was really interesting for me to hear 14 people teach the Dharma in their own way, in what was meaningful to them in the second noble truth. And to be honest with you, I was very impressed as a teacher. I thought, oh, I was really quite happy that so many of them have really taken the time to learn the Dharma and to apply it in their own lives and are learning how to share it in a skillful, meaningful way. But I was also struck by the wide variety of the different meanings people gave the second noble truth and the way they've applied it in their life. So it was again, another example of a perception is everything. So I thought since it was so, since I think the four noble truths are so central to our path, I thought this morning I would speak on the second noble truth. So I would imagine that most of you, but probably not all of you, are familiar with the Four Noble Truths of Buddha. Unfortunately, the Four Noble Truths have a bad reputation in the sense that they are considered like basic Buddhism, right? You know. But the Four Noble Truths came out of the Buddha's enlightenment. He didn't teach the Four Noble Truths until he had a deep and profound transformative experience of his own mind. And during that whole process, he looked deeply into his own mind to understand the source of suffering. Right. So the Four Noble Truths were actually the culmination, the product of his enlightenment. So it's important that we not reduce them to a syllogism or a paradigm. That the Buddha, that's, you know, basic Buddhism. It's basic Buddhism. It's what's it, middle level Buddhism. It's the highest Buddhism. It's the essence of Buddhism. Actually, it is said in the tradition that to enter the world of the enlightened is to deeply realize the Four Noble Truths. So I want to focus this morning on the second noble truth, but just very quickly. The Buddha was very concerned with suffering, right? And again, you know, many people think, to come to Buddhism is to come because of suffering. You have to have a lot of suffering in your life. And that's certainly true, that many people do take a turn in their life, because of sufferings, either internal or external, that challenge them. And they... Yeah, so they turn towards spirituality, let's say. But the Buddha, as you know, he wasn't suffering. He was sort of in the peak of his life. He was late 20s, newly married, child. He was, among the elite of his society, had a very easy life and a good life. But he was troubled by impermanence, you see, when he discovered the fragility of this life. That is what caused him to search. And again, I don't think anything's changed, right? I mean, all we have to do is read the paper. Or we don't read the paper anymore. All we have to do is, what, go on the web. Forgive me, dating myself. Things burn up so quickly, don't they? Things are floods just remove things so quickly, right? Things dry up so quickly, right? Disease, viruses spread so quickly, right? Life is destroyed so quickly, right? It's quite amazing when we reflect on the fragility of our life, right? For those who are older could understand when I say youth lasts such a short time. Before you know it, things have changed. So it was this kind of suffering, as well as many other kinds of sufferings, I won't go into it today, that propelled the Buddha into his spiritual search. And I think that is important because the essence of Buddhist practice is to look deeply into life, to understand truly, why is it that I'm not happy? Why is it that my mind is not at peace? And then we can look around and go, and why is it that so many other people aren't happy? So many other people, their minds aren't at peace, right? So that that looking deeply into life with a questioning. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? It's quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinary that we have this capacity to reflect on our life and ask ourselves deeper questions. So please understand that really is really what meditation is about. It's the ability of looking deeply into our own minds the way the Buddha did to uncover the source of suffering as well as the sources we'll see of happiness and well-being. So again, it was this willingness to turn inward and to ask himself, what is the cause of human suffering? Why do people act the way they do? Why do I act the way they do? So please understand that this is a process that we all need to participate in, because that energizes us to find answers. If we just kind of skim through life, if we just kind of go, well, it's just the nature of things, everybody. It's not the nature of things. Right? Sickness, old age, and death is the nature of things. Right? That we can do nothing about. But our own internal suffering, our own internal unhappiness, our own internal anxieties and fears and sadnesses and depressions and addictions and, on and on and on, right? No, this is because of us, the way we're responding to life, right? So the Buddha wanted to go, so what is the cause? So that's the second noble truth, right? What is the cause of suffering? And again, I just want to say again, I hope that everyone listening to this talk takes time in their life to reflect. This is meditation. This is taking time out of one's life. People just, days go by, weeks go by, months go by, years go by. The older you get, decades go by. And people never stop and ask the big questions, right? or when they do suffer in their life, they never go inward. Right. So this kind of reflection. Please understand, it's not just drinking my tea mindfully. It's not just enjoying my tea. Right. There's nothing liberating in that. I mean, in the moment, that's facilitates an ability to be to have a pleasurable experience in life, to be present. That's very good. But it's this willingness to look deeply underneath the surface that really is the hallmark of the Buddha's path. Please understand that. So the question becomes, why do I suffer? Why do all human beings suffer? The word is dukkha, right? Why is there emotional affliction? Right? We know animals suffer from cold, extreme cold and heat. Animals suffer from disease. Animals suffer when they're preyed upon. I mean, animals suffer, but their suffering is very direct in the moment to something that's happening. But our suffering's not like that, is it? Our suffering we carry with us. Right? All day we carry it with us. All week we carry it with us. Years we carry it with us. Right? So our suffering is different than just the normal kind of animalistic suffering. Because our suffering is of the mind, of the heart and mind. And so this is, to understand the cause of my suffering is to really understand the cause of everyone's suffering. Now, the third noble truth is the end of suffering, right? The cessation of suffering. But I'm going to focus on the second, because this is important. Because in the Buddha's realization, the first noble truth is we have to recognize the truth of suffering. The second noble truth is we have to uproot the cause of suffering, right? So the first noble truth needs to be acknowledged and recognized, right? The truth of suffering. But the second noble truth is not just recognizing the cause, it's uprooting the cause. That's very important. It's not just an intellectual kind of game, philosophical game. It's very personal, right? So once, again, Buddha was very clear. When we understand the cause of suffering, it must be uprooted. Okay? When our suffering is uprooted, we've realized the truth of the second noble truth, then we have the capacity of what? Of nirvana. Right? Of experiencing life without suffering. The third noble truth, there is an end to suffering, right? Again, that needs to be experienced. How is it experienced? By uprooting the causes. Is that clear? So that's, and then the fourth noble truth is the path, the path of practice. And he says the path of practice needs to be cultivated, it needs to be lived, it needs to be practiced. So, the Four Noble Truths, again, are not just, simple ways of understanding intellectually or philosophically. They delineate the path, a willingness to very honestly face the reality of our life, face the reality of life, face the reality of our own mind, honestly. And this is not about judgment, about all the things people get into. It's just, the mirror. We just hold up the mirror and acknowledge the truth of our own minds. Right? Then we look into causation. Oh, now I can see where it's all coming from. I vow to uproot it. Oh, the more I uproot it, the less suffering, nirvana. How do I do that? I practice the path. It's kind of simple. So what is the cause of suffering? Actually, you know what the Buddha said? He said, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths is the cause of suffering. It's very interesting. If you go back to the Buddha's teaching, I mean, there are lots of things that are that people say and the Buddha said about other things about the cause of suffering. But when he was teaching, the Four Noble Truths, he said, ignorance of the cause of suffering, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, you know, this is ignorance. Right? So we have to understand that the cause of our suffering is our ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end of suffering, and there's a path out of suffering. Okay? There's a path to nirvana. When we're no longer ignorant, right? When we know that, i.e. we have knowledge, we have wisdom, we have understanding, right? Then life is good. Even if externally life is not good. Right? Because one now understands where all our suffering is coming from. Right? So where is our suffering coming from? Anybody want to take a point me in the right direction? Where is our suffering coming from? Is it coming from our elbow? Sometimes our elbows hurt. We might think it's our elbows. Where is our suffering coming from? Think about your own suffering. Where is that? Where's our suffering? Where's our unhappiness? Where's our afflictions? Where's our all the things that go on in our life, all the drama of life, our internal life, our external life? Where is it all coming from? Our mind, but it's coming from our mind. It's all occurring in mind. Is that clear? It's not occurring anywhere else, right? Okay, so now, you see, now we know where to look at least, you know? Right? You know, it's like if there's a problem in life or, you know, external life, you know, where many, it's always amazing to me, many Dharma students in their real life, you know, like their work life, their other life, they're good problem solvers. Right? Many people, you know, their job involves solving problems. They problem solve all day. And yet when they come to the fundamental problem of their own life and mind, they go, what? You know what? Well, you know, I mean, I'm supposed to solve this problem? The problem of my own suffering? The problem of my own unhappiness? That's a more profound problem to solve. Right? Many of us are very good at solving little problems, but we're not very good at solving the real problem, right? The real problem of life. So we look into this mind, we finally go, all right, I got to look into my mind, and what do we see when we look into our mind? And we all see the same thing. What are we looking? We look in our mind and we see what? Thoughts. What else? We look in our mind, we look into our mind-body, and we see, we experience what? Emotions. We see thoughts, we see feelings, emotions. Yeah, desires, which again are thoughts and feelings, right? I mean, but it's kind of simple, isn't it? When you stop, that's really what's going on in there, isn't there? I mean, we have memories, which are just thoughts and images, pictures. We have hopes, we have fear, we have imaginations, but they're all just, we're imagining in what? In thought or images. Anything else going on that we're missing? Okay. So we look into our mind and we see, oh, and this is meditation. This is looking and we see, oh, what's going on in there? They're just thoughts endlessly arising and passing. There are thoughts that coalesce into sentences, that coalesce into paragraphs, that coalesce into stories, right? There are thoughts that coalesce into stories that connect to memories, that connect to other kind of internal formations within ourselves. You know, some become quite elaborate stories. Some are stories about the present, some are stories about our whole life, you know, but what are those stories made up? Thoughts. Attached to those thoughts, feeling states, mind states, you know, that are also, we can feel things in the body, right? So body and mind are connected. So am I missing anything? I mean, I'm just talking about our own minds. You see, this is, I always say this, we can all be experts in this. We don't need PhDs. All we're doing is talking about our own human experience, right? I mean, when people are sharing their human experience and we get together with people, they talk about what's going on in life, what are they doing? They're sharing their thoughts about life. They're sharing their memories of what's happening, what happened. They're sharing their thoughts about the future, their hopes for the future, right? But it's all, I mean, that's all they're doing, right? We're all doing the same thing. So this is kind of simple. I like to keep it simple. Just wait. I mean, there'll be time for discussion in the end. So we look in there and we see, yeah, what's going on? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, images, right? And there's no stability in there, is there? They're endlessly changing. Things I'm concerned about today, I wasn't concerned about last week. Things I'm happy about today, I wasn't happy about 10 years ago. You know what I mean? People that I have dramas with today, I never even knew, you know, never even entered my mind. You know what I mean? It's like, it's incredibly unstable, isn't it? Just keeps changing all the time. The dramas change, the thoughts change, the feelings change, the memories change, right? So what is the source of my suffering? It's a good question, isn't it? And again, it can be answered by looking within. The Buddha looked deeply within. And he saw that again, internally, that he saw all the things that I just shared. But he wasn't, you know, he didn't just stop at that, kind of an analysis of what I just said, you know, kind of a topography. We might call that what I just shared was a kind of giving the topography of the mind. Oh, this is what's going on in the mind. But he noticed what? That there are certain kinds of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, stories, memories that create sense of well-being, sense of ease, sense of happiness, right? And then he thought there was another whole set of thoughts, perceptions, ideas, stories, memories that created suffering, right? And again, we're talking about suffering that we can experience at this level. There are deeper levels of understanding this, but we're talking just about, you know, human experience. They're all mind states that we'd say are wholesome. They feel good. I mean, am I right to say that when we experience certain types of thoughts and feelings and memories, they don't feel good? Would everybody agree? I mean, it's right. And other types of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memory stories, when we experience them, we feel good. There's a sense of well-being, the sense of ease, a sense of happiness, a sense of warmth. Over here is not a lot of that, right? It's riled up. It's all riled up about something. Our fears, our anxieties, our angers, our irritations, you know, our sadnesses, our despair, they what? They rile us up, right? These other mind states don't rile us up, they calm us. They open us, they relax us. So he saw that, oh, the mind state and the experience of being a human being is predicated on one's experience of wholesome and unwholesome mind states. Right? Let me just say that again. Right? The experience we have within our own body-mind is predicated on our experience of wholesome or unwholesome mind states in the way I just spoke. Just reflect on that a minute. Just, is that true? Don't ask a question yet. Just reflect in yourself. Is that true? When I feel good, when I'm happy, when I'm at ease, it's because I'm experiencing wholesome mind states. When I'm unhappy, when I'm ill at ease, when I'm agitated, it's because I'm experiencing unwholesome mind states. So forgive me for the people who are online, but I'm sort of using the people in the hall as the kind of guinea pigs to make sure we're all on the same page. But we'll have time. I'm going to leave time for questions at the end. I mean, is that clear? All right. Now, that wholesome, unwholesome mind state, good thoughts, bad thoughts, that's good, isn't it? That's kind of a workable way, right? If we stop there, the Buddha could have said, well, that sort of gives people a path. Oh, no, I get the Buddha's path. Yeah. Positive thinking, right? Affirmations. Yeah, I'm just going to be I get it. I'll just be Pollyanna, right? Always look on the bright side of things. Always be optimistic. Always, no matter what happens, everything's for the best. Everything is wonderful, right? And I'll just stay away from the unwholesome, right? It could, and again, one could create kind of a false kind of happiness, couldn't they? Just by kind of manipulating that, right? And in popular culture, there's lots of that out there, and it has a temporary kind of work because it works, right? Your positive mind states, you feel good. And you act good or better. If you don't cultivate the unwholesome, the negative, it's good, right? Functionally, feels a lot better, show up a lot better, probably a better worker, better person, positive. It's good to be a positive person. But the Buddha, he went more deeply, right? What is the cause? You see, this cause is kind of looking more deeply. What's underneath? What's the cause of that? Right? So why do people have positive and wholesome and unwholesome, positive and negative thoughts, feelings? Right? Well, interpretation. Okay. Interpretation. What? What is it that gets to people? What is it about the way human beings relate to their experience that causes them to break it up into this positive, negative, good, bad, wholesome, unwholesome? How does that divide begin? You see, it's very interesting. What is the cause of that? Yeah, that's so now we're getting into, he looks more deeply and he sees there's something even deeper down. There's this self, this ego that kind of stands apart from life, from the unfolding of life with its own agenda, right? And when it likes what's going on, right? It what? Feels good. When it likes what's going on, it wants more of that. So it moves toward, it grasps at, it attaches to, it holds on to that which it wants. Right? Oh. So whether it's an object, whether it's a person, whether it's a thought, a belief, but whatever it is that the ego says, is me and I want it and I identify with it, it grabs onto and holds to. Now, there's a problem with that. Since everything's impermanent, nothing solid, nothing stays the same, that grasping and holding on to is totally, it's a fruitless endeavor because it doesn't understand the nature of what's of real life experience, that it is endlessly changing, that nothing can be held on to, that everything's unfolding according to causes and conditions. So the Buddha said it's this fundamental self, ego, experiencing the inner and outer world and dividing it up into wanted, unwanted, needed, unneeded, desired, not desired, and the movement toward, and of course I'm not talking about and away from, all the things it doesn't want. It doesn't want to experience, whether it's a thought, a mind state, a feeling state, a person, a situation, an unfolding of life. You know, that it is this endless bifurcation of grasping, aversion, of attaching and pushing away and breaking up basically an experience that is just one or as it is, causes this endless internal agitation, okay? This endless movement between positive and negative, happy, unhappy, up, down. And I could, you know, embroider, but that, it's that whole movement, it comes from this attaching, grasping, desiring, pushing away, not wanting, etc., that comes from this sense that I am this separate self, I am me, and I am separate from everything. And my job is to get as much as I can get and not get anything what I want. And that activity is what we experience as life. And the Buddha said, no, this is the cause of suffering. Always wanting to get what I want, not wanting to get what I don't want, always wanting fame and to be noticed, not wanting to be anonymous and not noticed, always wanting things to be pleasurable, never wanting things to be unpleasurable, always wanting the good things to last, never wanting the bad things to last. You know, it's this endless back and forth, which is just always keeping us in what the Buddha called the wheel. He called it the wheel of life, but not the good wheel of life. The wheel of life that just keeps us endlessly going up and down. We're elated, we're depressed. We're happy, we're sad. You know what I mean? Everybody understand what you mean? That's, he called that cycle. He said, that's suffering. And again, so he keeps tracing it back. So now we come down to the self. Right? All right, so this is, we're getting down into it, right? This is leading to this, is leading to this, is leading to this. And now we come to this self, this me, right? At the center of it all. And the Buddha then looked deeply into that. He looked deeply, deeply into his own mind, to the very structures of what is experienced and called myself, to find, is there any basis for it? Can I find a basis for it? Can I find a Fred? Can I find something solid in me that stands outside of everything else, stands outside of body and mind and all the experiences of body and mind, stand outside of thoughts, stands outside of feelings, stands outside of perceptions, stands outside of everything, and yet claims it all for itself? What is that? Okay. If you think about it, I was thinking about it before I came out. I thought, you know, they're making robots now, right? And robots kind of have bodies, don't they? And they can make them kind of move around and do all the things we do. And robots can see, right? They can manufacture things that robots can see, robots can hear, and robots can actually process information, can't they? Right? When we call a lot of these call centers, we don't even know if we're talking to a real person, right? Could be a, so I'm saying, so what is the difference if they can invent something that looks like us and can perform all our functions, which perhaps the world we're going to, what is the one thing that robots don't have? They don't have a self, do they? Right? They're just a bunch of processes. So they can look and probably do everything like us. The only difference is they won't suffer. So then somebody might say, is Fred suggesting that we all become like robots? No, but I think it's interesting that robots can do all the functions we do, except we have this one incredible thing that they don't have. We are aware. We have consciousness. We're aware. That is the unique thing about really who we are. And so the Buddha, looking deeply into his own mind, unable to find a solid, substantial, his name at that time was Siddhartha, so he couldn't find a Siddhartha in there. He couldn't find the culprit that was the source of all his desires and all his rejections, the source of everything. He couldn't find it. It wasn't like an intellectual he couldn't find it. He couldn't find anything. And yet, he was totally aware and present. And in that total dissolution of all the foundation stones of his life, he found liberation. He found freedom. And he said the whole artifice that had created the suffering has been destroyed. So coming back to the second noble truth, there is a cause of suffering. That cause of suffering is our ignorance of how things really are. How does it manifest? We strongly identify with the self. That's how it kind of begins to part. We strongly at a deep think we are a solid, permanent thing called me, right? And then out of that, see, how does that manifest? It manifests in all this, the way everything is self-referential, right? So we look at the world, we look at the things of the world, and we don't see it just as it is, wide open, free, right? We see everything as, do I want it? Do I don't want it? Right? What's in it for me? What's not in it for me? What can I get out of this? Nothing for me to get out of this. Let it, you see, we go through life, you know, what, you know, pleasures. I want pleasure. I don't want the opposite. I don't want the opposite of pleasure. No, no, no. So the center of our whole life is this self always trying to advance itself, always trying to protect itself. So he said, as one loosens this identification, this strong attachment to self, right? All these other things, all these other attachments and aversions and desires and needs, right, begin to soften, right? And again, coming back up, what I've been talking about now is a very internalized meditative process or reflective process. I don't make it sound like it's so difficult. It's a very self-reflective process where we understand what's going on within us, right? And then we come out of it and we still have to operate in the world, don't we? Oh, Now it's much easier to cultivate the wholesome and not cultivating the unwholesome, because the causes of all these unwholesome thoughts arising and all these unwholesome mind states arising, I've cut at the root, you see. And that's the Buddha said. He said, to look at the cause is to uproot the cause. And when you cut a plant at the root, when you take a plant at the root, it will not grow back. If you cut it at ground level, but you don't cut at the root, or you just cut or pull off the leaves, it'll grow back. And of course, that's what we do as human beings, right? We're endlessly, pruning ourselves, right? We're endlessly trying to cut away, the things that cause us suffering, and we're endlessly trying to, cultivate the flowers and the plants that we want, but we never get at the root of things. See, we never cut it off at the root. So, we want to cut it off at the root. Why? Because we don't want to be doing this forever. Do we? No, we don't want to be doing this forever. Because there's another way to live. A way to live that's much easier, much happier, much more wholesome, where the natural expression of love and connection and compassion and patience. It doesn't mean we're still not practicing, but it's much easier to practice because we're not so attached to ourself. We're not so needy, we're not so wanting, we're not so desirous, right? We're not so lonely. We don't feel deficient, we don't feel less than. See, these are all mind states of a self. Does your body ever feel lonely? Even if it's alone, does your body ever feel lonely? No. Our bodies don't feel lonely. And actually, our minds don't feel lonely. It's the self that's contaminating our mind, telling us, oh, this is not good. Wherever we are is not good. Why isn't it good? Because I want it to be different. Because I think if I have this in my life, then I'll be happy. You see? Anybody ever heard that voice in them? Endlessly telling them? Yeah. But it's this very voice that is causing us to be unhappy. See, that's what we don't get, you see? Because over here, it's a voice that's telling us, this is wrong, 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 right? So it keeps telling us all the things that are wrong, and then it says, but you're very lucky, I have the solution. See what a trickster it is, right? I have the solution for you. Get this, get this, get this, get this, get this, get this, right? And if we don't have insight, if we don't have some ability to see what's going on, it's very easily what? To be fooled. Because in the moment, we are what? We are not happy. And to be unhappy, and again, happy is I'm talking about all the afflictive mind states we get into, to be unhappy does not feel what? Doesn't feel good. So when all of a sudden this voice comes up with a solution, right? If we don't reflect, it's very easy for us to go, oh yeah. Yeah, you know what I mean? That's right. Let's go shopping. I get it. Let's go shopping. Let's go eat something. Let's go drink something. Let's go smoke something. You know? Let's go watch something. Let's go get something. A person, a thing. Yeah, because we want to be happy. You see, we want to feel whole. We want to feel fulfilled. That's common. I mean, that's good. So, second noble truth. This very profound. It's, you know, the four noble truths are really the Buddha's attempt, you know, and you've heard me say, and I'm sure you can read it too. You know, this was the first, you know, after his great enlightenment, right? And after going through all his, should I teach? Who's really interested in this? when he finally think, you know, maybe there are some out there. You know, this was the first teaching. The first people he taught were his Dharma buddies. Well, they weren't really his Dharma buddies then, but the ascetics that he had been practicing with, who were over in Deer Park near Sarnath. So this was the first teaching he gave them. I've discovered the cause of suffering. I've discovered the path out of suffering. I've discovered the path, the cause, and the way out. So let me stop now. Okay? So let me take questions. Before I take questions, let me just also say, this is doable by every one of us. Is it going to happen overnight? No. But the path is clear. You know, if by our reflection, and again, I really encourage us to reflect deeply on these teachings, very personal way, if we're able to identify the presence of suffering, dissatisfaction, alienation, whatever we want to call it, you know, in our life. And if we're willing to go deep inwardly to the cause, not outwardly, but inwardly, we will see the cause within ourselves, and we can use the Buddha's teachings as a guidepost, a template, a map to help us uncover that. Once you understand there's a cause, you know it's quite simple. If I end the cause, it'll cease. Very practical. Oh, and there is a very practical path that I can follow. The more diligently I follow it, the more sincerity I follow it with, the more commitment I have to it, there's probably a better chance that I will move through it. I will move through the stages of the path more quickly. So it's really up to us, right? But our energy for following the path is really based on these earlier ones. That's why he didn't just come in and go, you know, I have the path, right? I mean, you know, he could have written, seven steps, right? He could have joined, he could have made a mint. Seven steps to happiness. He was, you know, he could have just done that, couldn't he? He didn't do that. He did something much, much more profound. He took the time to set the stage. So when he enumerated his Eightfold Path, people had understanding, people had energy, people had enthusiasm. Oh, yeah. Suffering can be uprooted. There is a cessation of suffering. Wow. I'll buy into that. Sounds pretty good. Yeah. Oh, so now when you get to the seven steps to happiness, right, there's some energy behind it. But if we haven't done the first three really diligently and sincerely and very personally, our energy will be on, off, in, out. Yeah, so this is kind of big picture. This is wonderful. I mean, these Four Noble Truths. So we have time. Bill is upstairs, right? So you can chat in to Bill with your questions. People in the hall, if you have any questions. Again, questions about what's been said, questions about the process, questions about, you know, how that shows up in your own life. Please don't be shy. Yes. Yeah, we use it down here because most people are online. They want to hear.
Yeah. Willow here.
What?
Just was saying my name, Willow.
Yeah.
And when you speak, it makes total sense to me until I get to the part where it seems like you're saying there is no self because you can't find it. And I have to live on this plane of existence. You know, when you come out from that deep reflection, you have to live on this plane of existence, and I have to think of myself as a separate individual because I can't read your mind. I don't know what you're feeling. You know, I know what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking.
Right. So I understand.
There's no self.
Yeah. So the Buddha. So the Buddha doesn't say what the Buddha says, and what the Buddha's teaching is there is this sense, and whether it's a very primitive sense, right, a self-protective sense of me that all human beings have. That's, like you said, that's just normal. Everybody has a name, everybody's referred to it, or, you know, we all take responsibility for our actions. What he said is this identification, this strong identification with a self. Thinking that myself is a solid, you know, before I fall in love with that robot, right? Before I fall in love with that robot, I need to know what? There's nothing really there other than a bunch of processes. You see? What if that's really what's going on everywhere? Right? I mean, what if all these objects, these people, these things that I so desire, that I so spend so much time thinking about and grasping at, don't have any intrinsic. They have a temporary reality, you know? I mean, people talk about celebrities like they know them. Right? Okay, you see? As if they're really what they look like. But if you take these, you know, but all we're doing is seeing an image. it's not real in any real way. It's just images, right? We can watch movies and we can see all kinds of things and have all kinds of emotions, but we know, oh, there's nothing solid there, permanent there. I can have an experience, but I don't attach. I can have a dream, but I know they're not real, so I don't attach. It doesn't affect me. Right? I can have a happy dream, a sad dream, but when I wake up from the dream, I know it's just a dream. Gone. Gone. Right? So Buddhism doesn't teach there's not a self. It says the self that we experience or feel is not really a solid, permanent self. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. So it's very profound because there's the liberation. It's not like in Buddhism, there's not like two worlds, the spiritual world and the non-spiritual world, the world of self, the world. It's all the same world. It's just how you experience it, how you see it. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. And then Bill, just hold up your hand. There are a couple down here, but I'll come to you. You there are some people who are chatting in questions. Okay.
Hi, I'm Josiah. I think I'm having a misunderstanding of something along here.
Okay, good.
Because I feel like I'm still in ego and desire, but just more wholesome ego and desire. Mm-hmm. Like before, okay, you spend your life and go, oh, if you have movies and you have, you know, material possessions and you go travel, then, mm-hmm. oh, you're a movie connoisseur and a film critic and mm-hmm. you're a traveler and mm-hmm. and that'll make you happy. And then you live long enough and go, well, that's cool. That's pretty nice, but it's not really working. And then you come here and you go, okay, well, wholesome, unwholesome. I like wholesome. Okay, so if I'm stressed out, I'll listen to a Dharma talk. Oh, mm-hmm. I feel better, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, if I am feeling less centered in my life, oh, go hang out in meditation more often.
Good.
But isn't it still like, now I'm just going from, oh, I have this ego, I'm a traveler, I'm a movie connoisseur.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now
yeah.
I'm a Dharma practitioner,
that's
exactly, a new ego. Correct. And now I just have a new part of my mind going, oh, well, yeah, if you... Sometimes still go off and know if I feel bad, well, go eat some food and watch a movie.
All right.
The other time, you know?
All right, Hosea. So let me, Josea. So remember we said we keep taking it deeper. Well, just, he can hold it for a minute. Because I may, all right? See, the deeper question is, you said, well, when I'm stressed, I go meditate. Why? What's the cause of your stress, you see? Why are you stressed? Stress is an afflictive mind state. Stress is suffering. This is the deeper question. Why am I suffering? Why am I stressed? See, why is that? You see, this is where you go below what you're saying. Oh, I'm stressed, affliction, unwholesome. I'll go do something wholesome, meditate, watch a movie, right? You're right. That's the polarity of living with wholesome and unwholesome, which is kind of religion. Right? Teaches us do good things, don't do bad things. But the Buddha went deeper inside. Like, what's the cause of that? Why is even stress arising in your mind, Josiah? Is it arising in your mind? Would you grant it? I mean, there's no such thing as stress out here, is there? Flying
not
around
this
the
hall.
What?
Not very often in this hall.
Right, but anywhere. I mean, right? I mean, you work at a hospital. I know you're a nurse and all that stuff. I mean, is there such a thing as stress that you can see? Like, uh-oh, it's coming down the hall. I better duck into a room so I don't get stressed. Does it work like that? Where does your stress come from, Josiah?
I'm not sure, but if I had to guess right away, I'd say from seeing people in very difficult situations and them expressing suffering and not knowing how to really process that well.
Okay, so you would say the cause of my suffering is when I perceive suffering people and I feel I can't help them, it causes me stress. Well, who is it inside you who's all of a sudden decided that you should know how to do things? Or, I mean, that whole drama that you've created, that's been created where?
In the mind.
In your mind. So this is, now you're looking, you see, Josiah, you see the process? See, now you're kind of peeling back the layers. What's under that? What's under that? And what you do is you find this self that stands outside of life, wanting things to be this way and not wanting things to be that way. It's very simple, actually, even though each one of us have a different story. We all have different lives, you know, and it shows up differently. Show up in our personal life, our relationships, our work life, our relationship to the world, right? But it's all the same thing. Does that help you now? I mean, this is the unpacking. It's like, yeah, well, where's that coming from? Why is that arising? In my mind, as long as you think the stress is arising because there's sick people in the hospital, you're lost. Because your whole emotional life will depend on what's going on outside you. There's no freedom in that, is there? If I said, you're a nurse, you deal with suffering people, that's all you deal with, right? You don't deal with healthy people. They don't come to the hospital, do they? No, you deal with suffering people. Wouldn't you love to go to the hospital with a relaxed, open mind, compassionate, caring, doing your best, and without the other stuff, without the stress?
Yes.
Yeah, of course you would. Well, it's possible. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Bill, let me, I know. Okay.
The question is, where does the statement, I think, therefore I am, fit in the Buddha's teachings?
I think, therefore I am? I think, therefore I am. I don't think that's Buddhism. I think that's Descartes. What? I think, therefore I am. I think that's the opposite of Buddhism. Buddhism says thinking is just a thing that the conscious mind does. We have different levels of consciousness, right? We have eye consciousness that sees. We have ear consciousness that hears, right? We have the five senses of the body. And then our sixth consciousness, which we could say is the consciousness of the mind, which is functionally the same way that the other, like seeing, hearing, smelling, have a seat in an organ, like the eye or the ear. you know, we might say thinking has this, the organ of thinking is what? The brain. I mean, that's the organ. But there's something deeper than that, right? Thinking is just the way we process experience in the realm of words. But before experience enters the realm of words, there is the realm of pure experience. In the realm of words, there's difference. People who speak English, they process it in one way. People with Chinese, they process it another way. I mean, everybody, how many languages are there in this world? Many, many, many. But what's that about? That's just the thinking mind of all these individuals, the conscious mind in their own language, processing their experience. But underneath that, we're all having the same experience. So what we want to find out is, yeah, my problem up to now is, you know, I think, therefore I am. I am my thoughts. Buddhism doesn't say that. Buddhism says, no, the I am is aware of what the thoughts are. Because we can be aware of our thoughts. How can we say I'm my thoughts if I can be aware of my thoughts? I can watch my thoughts. I can change my thoughts. Thoughts are just an instrument that we use. But unfortunately, we've forgotten that. And we've totally identified. That's another false identification, right? I am my thoughts. That would be frightening for many of us, wouldn't it? Are there questions?
Yeah, for the next one is, the cause of suffering is mind or self, not others. So if I take a pain medication to avoid physical and mental pain, am I fooling myself?
Well, I'm not sure what that means. Again, there are endless ways to temporarily, you know, stop suffering. There are endless ways temporarily to find transitory moments of happiness. That is basically what most human life's about. But when the Buddha realized that there's no end to that, and most importantly, realized that even his time as a human being was very time limited and very fragile because of sickness, old age, and death, and all the impermanence. That's also, you know, why he looked deeply, said, no, I want to find a happiness and well-being and peace of mind that is deeper than this endless back and forth, right? That most of us do, seeking happiness here, avoiding unhappiness there. You know, he said this endless thing, you know, it's again, I mean, all that medications do or drugs do or alcohol does or all these other things, they just temporarily, you know, stop us from suffering and temporarily allow us to feel good. I get it. Why do you think, you know, half the world's addicted to something? And it's only growing. Why is that? Because people want to be happy. People don't want to suffer. I get it. Don't we all get it? There's nothing, you see, that's good, you see. But because people haven't really done the internal work of reflection and found a way that produces more meaning and constancy of well-being, they're endlessly lost in that temporary fix, right? And there are endless possibilities in this world for temporary fixes. Yeah, so, we can be in pain. And again, I'm not saying if you're really in pain, you know, pain medication can be helpful. I'm not saying, but understand, you know, that's not what we're talking about here. Okay, Susan, do you still have a question or are you good? Okay. Uh-huh. Susan's been waiting patiently, and so she'll be the last question.
Yeah, You asked us what's in our mind, and thoughts, feelings, emotions. And I wondered about space.
Well, there's lots of very different qualities to our mind. But I'm saying what we notice most of the time is, right. So if I said to the people in the hall or people at home, you know, what's in your room? Pretty much everybody go, well, there are chairs and there are people and there are cushions and there's a bell and there's a dun, and I see wall. You know, we go to the objects. But if the truth is, you know, the biggest thing in this hall is space. We don't notice the space. Why don't we notice the space? Because we're fixated on the objects. Yeah, I mean, part of our meditation life is to kind of notice the inner space. Yep. But that's another Dharma talk. So good. Thank you all, and thank the people in the presenter training for allowing me to listen to your talks and for reminding me of how important the Four Noble Truths are. Thank you, everyone.